From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Perhaps no politician of this century knew how to use power better than Lyndon Johnson. On this edition of Fresh Air, Johnson's biographer Robert Caro tells us that LBJ abused that power to steal an election. Also, Soviet emigre artists Komar and Melamed tell us about the lack of freedom that drove them out of Moscow. They say things are different, but not necessarily better, in the New York art scene. Rock historian Ed Ward looks at some of the music inspired by the Vietnam War. And book critic John Leonard reviews the new biography of French philosopher Simone Weil. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Namibia, Africa's last colony, became independent just 2 hours ago. NPR's John Madison reports from the capital of Windhoek that it was a colorful ceremony, and it took place before an excited crowd.
The flag of Africa's last colonial power, South Africa, was lowered for the last time after a speech by President F.W. de Klerk announcing his country's withdrawal from Namibia. The new red, green, and blue flag with a bright yellow sun was raised in its place. Then United Nations Secretary General Pérez de Cuellar swore in Namibia's first president, Sam Nujoma, leader of SWAPO, the liberation movement that won the majority of the votes in elections last November. The ceremony in the newly renamed Independence Stadium followed a 23-year Bush war, decades-long battles in the World Court, and then years of diplomacy involving the United States, the Soviet Union, and dozens of other countries. South Africa's decision to concede independence has won it some benefits. Today, for the first time, President de Klerk is meeting heads of state and foreign ministers who've refused to meet him in the past. I'm John Madison in Windhoek, Namibia.
President Bush prodded Congress today to act quickly on an $800 million aid package for Panama and Nicaragua. The president invited Democratic and Republican congressional leaders to the White House to press for fast action on his Fund for Democracy, an aid package for the new Central American governments. Mr. Bush told the lawmakers that success for the new U.S.-backed governments could increase the pressure for change in Fidel Castro's Cuba. Senator Patrick Leahy, chairman of the Appropriations Subcommittee that's considering the aid package, said the administration wasn't being clear enough about where the money will go and what it will be used for. In Budapest, a crowd estimated at over 50,000 today held a rally to protest attacks by Romanian nationalists on ethnic Hungarians in the Romanian region of Transylvania. Sylvia Poggioli reports from Budapest.
Today's rally followed 5 days of clashes in Transylvania, which Hungarians consider the cradle of their culture. The rally was organized by a large grouping of the new Hungarian opposition political parties. Many speakers said they had supported the Romanian people during the revolution that toppled the dictator Ceausescu, but now they warned of the danger of fascism emerging in their neighboring country. Hungarian radio reported that two ethnic Hungarians had died following the attacks by axe-wielding Romanians. The Hungarian government demanded immediate action by Romania and the United Nations and protested that Romanian police stood by during the attacks. 2 million Hungarians live in Transylvania and make up the largest ethnic minority in Europe. In Budapest, this is Sylvia Poggioli reporting.
Prices dropped on Wall Street today, ending 4 sessions of advance. Analysts say that investor profit-taking pushed the Dow Jones Industrial Average down nearly 17 points. The Dow closed at 2,738.74 in active trading. This is NPR News. The racketeering trial of former Philippine First Lady Imelda Marcos began with jury selection today in New York. Mrs. Marcos is charged with helping her late husband, former Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos, with plundering their country's treasury and using the money for secret real estate purchases in New York. A legal setback today for anti-abortion activists. A federal appeals court in Boston has ruled the government cannot prevent federally subsidized clinics from suggesting abortion to their patients. Anthony Brooks of member station WBUR reports from Boston.
Is particularly significant following last summer's U.S. Supreme Court decision further empowering the states to limit abortion. Today's decision calls the Bush administration's policy of prohibiting federally subsidized clinics from dispensing information about abortion an unconstitutional assault on free speech. Massachusetts Attorney General James Shannon joined with abortion rights groups to challenge that policy.
What we're talking about here are really two fundamental rights. the right of a woman to make the most private decision concerning herself and her own health, and the right of a doctor and a patient to enter into a conversation without the interference of the federal government.
Shannon says he expects to be arguing the case before the U.S. Supreme Court eventually, because another appeals court in New York ruled differently on the same issue. For National Public Radio, this is Anthony Brooks in Boston.
The vice president-elect in Nicaragua's incoming government said today that the Sandinista Front was attempting to discredit him with an accusation of fraud. The allegations against Virgilio Godoy involve research foundation funds. Godoy was elected along with Violeta Chamorro, whose U.S.-backed UNO coalition swept the Nicaraguan elections last month. A criminal charge against Godoy was thrown out of court today on a technicality, but the judge said the charge could be filed again. I'm Corey Flintoff. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Robert Caro has spent the past 14 years researching the life of Lyndon Johnson, and he's not finished yet. The first volume of his biography of Johnson was a bestseller and won a National Book Critics Circle Award. Volume 2 has just been published. Johnson was a master politician, but Caro says LBJ used his political skills in corrupt ways to increase his personal power. That's illustrated in Caro's new book, Means of Ascent, which covers the years 1941 to 48. 1948 was the year Johnson was first elected to the Senate. He lost the Senate race 8 years before, his career stalled in the House, and 1948 looked like his last chance out. According to Caro, Johnson was desperate to win. He won by only 87 votes. There were rumors that he'd stolen the election. Johnson managed to stop a federal court's investigation into the final vote. But Robert Caro's book offers proof that 200 phony votes were added for Johnson several days after the election during a recount. Robert Caro says, as a biographer, he's not just writing about great men. He's writing about how power works. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his earlier book, The Power Broker, Robert Moses and the Fall of New York. I asked him why Lyndon Johnson made a good subject for an investigation into the workings of power.
Because I think he understood the uses of national power, how you got it and how you used it, better than any president of our time. The thing that first attracted me to him was his, not his presidency, in fact, but his Senate majority leadership, because everyone said that no one ever dominated and controlled the United States Senate as he did. So I thought if I could show how he did that, I'd really be showing something about national power.
But it kept sending you further and deeper into his life?
Yes.
Now, most of your new book is about how Johnson won or stole the 1948 Senate election in Texas. Before we talk about the specifics and before we talk about the stolen votes, tell us why you spend so much time on this one election. What do you think its significance is?
Well, it's a terrific question, because I spend so much time on it not because it's stolen, but because it marked the transformation in American politics. His opponent, a beloved former governor of Texas named Coke Stevenson, was the perfect example of the old politics before we had media advisors and packaged candidates. His campaigns consisted of Stevenson would simply drive around from one little town in Texas to the other. In each town, he'd give a speech on the courthouse lawn or on Main Street. It was just him and the voters. There were no media advisors between him and them. Lyndon Johnson in 1948 was the new politics. He didn't invent it, but he brought it to fruition. He was media politics, electronic politics, technological politics, media advisors, advertising firms, commercials, radio saturation of the state. And with this, we see the collision of the old and the new politics, and the new politics really destroyed the old. There would never be a Coke Stevenson-type campaign in Texas again or in the Southwest. It was the end of an era.
Well, you describe how Stevenson was going from one rural place to another shaking hands, and Johnson had chartered a helicopter, and he'd fly in.
Right.
And why was that so innovative?
Well, it was a wonderful campaign device, because Few people had seen a helicopter in 1948. The idea to these small townspeople of a flying machine that could stand still in midair was just awe-inspiring to them. So it attracted crowds, which is what every politician wants to do, of course. But it also enabled Johnson to eliminate the great handicap to campaigning in Texas, which is the enormous distances of the state. You know, all of a sudden, it was easier to get around the state.
Now, perhaps the greatest revelation in your book is the details of how votes were forged after the election, when a recount was called, to win the election. So the election was won on these forged votes. Now, you tracked down the man who actually created these votes.
Certified the votes, yes.
Certified the votes. His name was Luis Salas.
Yes.
And how did you find him?
Well, that wasn't very hard. He had moved from Alice. I mean, it wasn't one of the great feats of investigative reporting. I had been told at first he was dead, and I was interviewing people down in this little town of Alice, and someone said, oh, no, he lives with his daughter in Houston. In my memory, it's been years ago, I simply started calling every Salas in Houston until I found him. The wonderful thing was that, you know, in the time I was writing about, he was described, he was really the enforcer, a huge, burly, gun-toting Mexican-American enforcer for George Parr, the notorious Duke of Duval, which is the area that down near the Rio Grande where these votes came from. And that's what I was expecting when I finally found him. He was living in a mobile home behind his daughter's house. And I knocked on the door of the mobile home, and I expected Luis Salas to open the door. But, of course, it was almost 40 years later. He was 84 years old, and what opened the door was this stooped, gentle, rather frail old man in gold-rimmed glasses. But that was Luis Salas.
And it turned out that he had written all about this in a manuscript.
Yes, one of the decisive moments in putting this all together was, you know, I started to ask him about Box 13. That was Precinct 13 in Alice, in Jim Wells County, Texas, where these last votes came from 6 days after the election. And he said, Robert, I have written it all down. And he walked over to this large trunk, and he bent down and pulled out this manuscript, and I looked at the title, and the title was Box 13. And in fact, he had written down the story of what happened. Now, of course, that wouldn't have been significant, except that I had previously read all the court transcripts. There's over 1,000 pages of court transcripts, because there were hearings held on this at the time, just no one seems to know about them anymore. And all the other witnesses testified one way, which really was basically that the election had to been stolen. The only person who testified the other way was Luis Salas. He cast doubt on all their testimony, and he was the election judge of Precinct 13. And when I asked him about this, he said, well, Robert, I lied under oath. And he then told me, and told in his manuscript, a story that totally confirmed what everybody else said. So now everyone was testifying the same way, and all the doubts were removed.
Did he tell you if Johnson specifically knew about these votes and if they were forged because he requested it?
Well, Salas says that Johnson personally requested it. I say in my book, which is what I believe to be true, that this is the only point in the whole election that is not confirmed. And therefore, I do not say it in the book, that Johnson came personally. But I also say that it wasn't just these votes, you know, that were stolen for Lyndon Johnson. And I say that the question of whether Johnson flew to Alice and asked personally for those votes, or whether he did it over the telephone, or whether he did it through his advisors, would be significant only if people were contending that Johnson did not play an active role in the entire campaign strategy, and nobody is seriously saying that.
Robert Caro is my guest, and the second volume of his biography of Lyndon Johnson has just been published. It's called Means of Ascent and covers the years 1941 to 1948. Well, this is really a fascinating case study in how votes were stolen at the time. So let's look at how this worked. First of all, since you had access to Salas's notes, now, how did he actually forge the 200 votes?
Well, he didn't forge it. He refused to do that. He said that if other people did it, he would certify. See, the election judge has to certify the names.
He didn't want them all in his handwriting.
No, but in fact, they turned out to be mostly in someone else's handwriting and in alphabetical order, as if these last 200 voters had come to the polls in alphabetical order. And during the series of court hearings that followed this, enough witnesses testified whose names were there as having voted, because they had signed the poll list, you know, as having voted, testified that they had not, in fact, voted. You know, one said he was in another town 107 miles away. You know, they said they had not voted at all.
Now, this story was known. There'd been a lot of stories over the years about Box 13 and the stolen votes. And you say that Johnson even told jokes about it himself.
Yeah.
I can't understand why all of this didn't tarnish his reputation, how it could just be kept on the level of interesting anecdotes about a legendary president, you know?
Well, you know, that's that's a question that it takes me an entire chapter to examine in the book. I'm not sure I can sum it up. He did tell jokes and boasted about it in Washington. As a matter of fact, you know, he got the nickname from the election, Landslide Lyndon, and he played at least a role in nicknaming himself Landslide Lyndon. He liked the nickname for a while. As soon as he shortly came to dislike it, but he could never stop himself from telling jokes about it. For 40 years, he and his apologists said, either they said it wasn't really stolen, or they said if he stole it, it wasn't anything more than was the run of Texas politics. Now, I wanted to find out if that was true or not. So I analyzed the last 15 elections before the 1948 campaign, going back to 1932, every election for governor or senator in that period. And in none of them had this happened. Johnson went beyond the bounds of Texas politics, but we really didn't know that.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk more about your biography of Lyndon Johnson. Robert Caro is my guest, and the second volume of his biography has just been published. This one's called Means of Ascent, and it covers Lyndon Johnson from 1941 to 1948. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Robert Caro is my guest, and we're discussing his biography of Lyndon Johnson. The second volume has just been published. You describe Lyndon Johnson as having a genius for secrecy. Now, we have some example of that in the story that you've been telling about the 200 stolen votes and all the other stolen votes in this 1948 election. But even going back to his high school years, you talk about how he stole an election there.
College.
Yeah. And you just trace the history of this throughout his life. And you indicate that you think it's no surprise that it was during his presidency that the expression, the credibility gap, was coined.
Well, there was a fabric of basic trust where a president could count on the support of the American people in times of foreign policy crises. And I cite Eisenhower and the U-2 incident and Kennedy at the summit with Khrushchev. The nation, whatever they thought, rallied behind. After Lyndon Johnson's presidency, that fabric was torn apart, and we've never believed in our presidents the same way since.
Well, I mean, do you think that the discrepancies between fact and official statement about Vietnam, for instance, during the Johnson years, was as much an expression of his genius for secrecy as it was for just the way politics in general was heading then? I mean, do you think that Johnson brought a new level of secrecy to the presidency?
I don't really want to talk about Johnson's presidency because I haven't completed all the research on that.
Okay, and you feel like you haven't fully thought it through yet.
Well, I don't know about that, but I know that I don't want to talk about it verbally for the first time.
Okay. When you were researching this volume of Johnson's biography, did you find yourself thinking a lot how American history would have been changed if these 200 votes weren't stolen to win the election?
Every day. Johnson's presidency, I don't want to, as I said, go into details, but it was a watershed presidency, by which I mean the country was different before he came to power than when he left. If he hadn't gotten those 200 votes, which really were reported 6 days after the election, he would not have been senator. He would have left politics. He would probably never have been president. And I do think history would have been different.
The current volume of your biography has examples of his manipulative way, Johnson's manipulative way of playing politics.
Yeah.
Do you think that when he got to the Senate and then when he became president, that he often used his manipulative skills to do good?
Oh, yes. Every time I see David Dinkins, I think Lyndon Johnson. When I read about the governor of Virginia, Wilder, I think Lyndon Johnson. The other day, there was an article in the paper about the southern communities. I think the number was 1,747. I'm not exactly sure of that. That have southern mayors today, where almost none of them had southern mayors before Lyndon Johnson. If it wasn't for him, I believe that we might not have some of the civil rights legislation today that he got through. And the story, you know, I say in the introduction that among the aspects of Lyndon Johnson's presidency, particularly civil rights, were advances in the cause of social legislation that liberals had been dreaming of for decades and hadn't been able to get through. And Johnson, with his matchless political genius, whether you call it manipulation or whatever, his savage energy, his determination to win, and a strain of compassion for what I call the dispossessed of society, was a great champion in their cause. I said it was Abraham Lincoln who struck the chains from black Americans, but it was Lyndon Johnson who took them by the arm, led them into the voting booth, closed democracy's curtain behind them, and made them once and forever a true part of American political life.
Did Lady Bird cooperate with you in the writing of this book?
Well, she cooperated with me for a while. We had 10 interviews. They were very valuable interviews. She didn't keep a diary, but she had a logbook from these early years, you know, sort of an expanded schedule thing. And she'd go through it year by year, and, you know, it would remind her of things. So long before anything was published, the first volume or anything, she stopped talking to me, and indeed most of the cooperation of the Johnson people stopped. That's now resumed, but I've never gone back, you know, to talk to her.
Why not?
Well, I feel that she probably... one of the things that made me saddest, you know, about the things I was finding out about, you know, when I talked to her, I realized that this was a woman who truly loved her husband. I mean, you just couldn't not listen to her talk and not know that. I had, before my first interview with her, you know, I had heard all these stories about how shamefully he treated her, which is correct. He treated her shamefully. And I wondered when I went in to see her the first time how she really felt about Lyndon. And it was in that very first interview, I remember just thinking, this is a woman who totally loves her husband. And the only thing that really saddened me about the things you had to write about Lyndon Johnson to portray a truthful, give a truthful portrait of his life, was that I knew that if she read them, she would be very saddened. She says she's never read the book, but I just don't feel myself that going back to bother her is something that I want to do.
Well, you've found out that Johnson had a mistress for a long time. Do you know if Lady Bird knew about that?
I don't know. I'm glad I'm not writing about Mrs. Johnson. I'm glad I'm writing about Mr. Johnson, whom I think I understand, because I don't pretend that I know about Mrs. Johnson. The mistress, of course, was very important in Johnson's early life. She was a political mentor. to him. She was, as you know, a much more sophisticated, elegant hostess with a great estate in Virginia. Johnson was a tall, gangling, lanky, totally unsophisticated new congressman. And his entire character emerges in his relationship with Alice Glass. And for that reason, I really felt it was necessary to portray this relationship in detail.
Why didn't you ask Lady Bird, though, if she knew about the mistress? Because it just seems to me it's an important part of the Johnson story to know whether his wife knew about this or not.
Well, I'll answer that question. It's not something that after one day, Alice Glass came from a little town called Marlin, and I had been spending a lot of time up there. And one day, someone I had been talking to called me up in sort of a panic and said, Bird, in Texas people call Lady Bird, Bird knows you know about Alice. And I said, well, that was inevitable, you know, the next time we were going to have an interview, her secretary came in and said, Mrs. Johnson would like to see you out at the ranch this, whatever it was, Saturday, I think. So I went out to the ranch, and there was no one there but Mrs. Johnson and myself. And all morning we simply did what we had been doing, went through one of these log books, you know, for another year, and then came lunch. She was sitting at the head of the table, and I was sitting, you know, at her right with my notebook down on my right hand, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, she began talking about Alice Glass, and I quote what she said, you know, in the book. And if you want to know why I didn't ask her more questions about it, I can only tell you I was too embarrassed. It was the only time in my life that I simply could not bring myself to ask a question, maybe because I didn't want to hurt her. Maybe it was out of embarrassment, I don't know. But I remember during all the time she was talking about Alice Glass, I just couldn't raise my eyes from my notepad.
Robert Caro is my guest, and we're talking about his biography of Lyndon Johnson. The second volume has just been published. Now, you've told us that you're especially interested in power and studying power, how it works in this country, how it's used. Why are you so interested in power? And I wonder, I mean, do you want to have power yourself? I mean, you're just interested in people who have it. Would you like your share?
I have to say that that's one accusation that I'm innocent of. I cannot even stand working with committees or other people. It's a lucky thing that to some extent I can write because I like to work alone. I'm interested in the workings of power because when I was a reporter, I started to see how power worked.
I think one feeling I walk away with from your second volume of the Johnson biography is, boy, is American politics corrupt.
Well, the politics in this election certainly was corrupt. And, you know, it's something I think we have to understand because Lenin wrote that power comes, in communism at any rate, power comes from the barrel of a gun. But in a democracy, power comes from the voting booth. We have to understand everything about elections if we're really going to understand about political power, which shapes all our lives.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I appreciate it.
Robert Caro's new volume in his biography of Lyndon Johnson is titled Means of Ascent, and it covers the years 1941 to 48. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, journalist T.J. English on his investigation of the Westies, that's the Irish mob in New York's Hell's Kitchen. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Vitaly Komar and Alexander Melamed have a new exhibit at the Brooklyn Museum, a multimedia work made up of nearly 60 panels showing scenes from Soviet history and from the artists' lives before they emigrated. Coming up, we talk with Komar and Melamed about life and art in Moscow and New York. Also, rock historian Ed Ward gives us a sample of some of the songs written about the Vietnam War from both ends of the political spectrum. And book critic John Leonard reviews Utopian Pessimist, David McClellan's biography of French philosopher and mystic Simone Weil. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A new country has joined the nations of the world tonight as Namibia became independent from South Africa. More than 20,000 people, including scores of government leaders, attended the independence ceremonies. South African President F.W. de Klerk was the last speaker before his country's flag was lowered in Namibia and the nation's new flag was raised. Secretary of State Baker led the U.S. delegation to the ceremonies. The West German cabinet today decided to stop handling East German immigrants as refugees in hopes of slowing down the immigration flow. Deidre Berger has more.
As of July 1st, East Germans will no longer be entitled to temporary housing quarters at government expense if they move to West Germany. They will also stop receiving $115 in welcome money and interest-free loans for home furnishings. Bonn Interior Minister Wolfgang Schäuble emphasized no one will be turned away at the border, but said new arrivals will be dealt with as homeless West Germans. Schäuble also said the government believes an impending economic and currency union with East Germany will convince more people to stay at home. The 10 West German states and Berlin have demanded an immediate stop to the refugee status for East Germans, and two states have already refused to accept any new arrivals from East Germany. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Cologne.
Israeli President Herzog has empowered Labor Party Chairman Shimon Peres with the task of forming a new government. This follows the collapse last week of the Likud government of Yitzhak Shamir by a vote of no confidence over his handling of the peace process. Patricia Golan has more on the story.
After 3 days of consultations with all 17 political parties who hold seats in the parliament, President Herzog announced his choice. He explained that faced with a tie between Shimon Peres and Yitzhak Shamir, with 60 delegates supporting each, he had to take into account other criteria. He said the Shamir government had been overthrown in the Knesset by a vote of no confidence, which created a moral obligation to give the alternative party and political philosophy a chance. But above all, the president said he felt Peres had a better chance of forming a new government quickly. Peres has 21 days to put together a new coalition. His task will not be easy. At least four of those supporting him, the Communist Party members, are traditionally not asked to join a coalition. This means that Peres has to attract at least two of the small ultra-religious parties away from the Likud. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down almost 17 points to close at 2,738.74, on volume of some 177 million shares. Trading was very active. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Many of the movies that have come out about the Vietnam War have had soundtracks that include songs you can hear on any classic rock station by Jimi Hendrix and The Doors. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward examines some of the lesser-known music of the period that actually commented on the war.
I hear people talking bad about the way they have to live here in this country. Harping on the wars we fight, griping about the way things ought to be. I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down our country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me.
The Vietnam War was a curious thing. It divided our country as no war since the Civil War had. And it did so at a time when popular music here was expressing ideas and concerns more overtly than it ever had. Yet there were very few songs that came out and talked about what was going on over in Southeast Asia that succeeded with the public. The great exception, of course, was Staff Sergeant Barry Sadler's famous Ballad of the Green Berets, which spent 3 months on the charts in 1966, much to the disgust of the many young people who were discovering another way of life and another way of looking at politics.
Fighting soldiers from the sky, fearless men who jump and die, men who mean just what they say, the brave men of the Green Beret.
There were plenty of protest songs, of course, but they were mostly examples of what one cowboy I know calls preaching to the choir, not really intended to change anybody's mind. Anyway, as Barry Sadler demonstrated, the best way to get onto the radio was to be pro-Vietnam. But as early as 1968, you could hear a bit of protest sneaking in on a weird reworking of Vaya Con Dios by Charlie and Inez Fox, who were best known for the 1963 hit Mockingbird. Check this out.
There's a thing that's going on today, and I'm quite sure you know what I'm talking about when I tell you it's the war in Vietnam. The fellas that are being sent over there are from the age of 16, 17, 18, and 19, and 20, 21 years of age. They're just like babies being snatched from their mother's arms. You give them a gun and tell them to shoot, and I mean kill.
Of course, Joe Tex countered this with a rewrite of a World War II favorite, in which a soldier in Vietnam gets so inspired by a letter from his mother that he jumps up and shoots a half dozen of the enemy. In 1969, A&M Records decided they'd discovered a new dance sensation and put out a song called Wonderful World, Beautiful People, sung by Jimmy Cliff, to exploit it. The song did well enough that an album followed, and although this tune died as a single, Bob Dylan pronounced it the best protest song he'd ever heard. Naturally, if you've ever heard a song like this before, you know what happens. The friend is killed before his tour of duty is over, and his mother gets a telegram telling her of his death. It's simple, but that relentless rhythm gives it an urgency that makes it a classic. 2 years later, the war was more unpopular than ever, and although the record was banned on many radio stations, Freda Payne's best-selling Bring the Boys Home laid it out very clearly. Bring the Boys Home struck a responsive chord with black audiences, who put it into the soul top 10. But I knew the war was on its way out in 1972, when Grand Funk Railroad, a band that was despised by critics but loved by working-class rock and roll fans, put out a record called People, Let's Stop the War. Like everything else the band released around that time, the album it was on sold very well, even if the song wasn't put out as a single.
Stop the war, boy.
I've always considered it rather silly that the various protest songs college students sang to each other have been given so much credit for reflecting the anti-war sentiments of the American people during Vietnam, when it was perfectly obvious that these songs I've just played, which are only a sampling of the ones released, never got the attention they deserved. Grand Funk Railroad's Mark Farner went on to become the only rock star to publicly support Richard Nixon in 1972. But if public sentiment told him that opposing the Vietnam War could make him money, then maybe Washington was listening, too.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. This is Fresh Air. Vitaly Komar and Alexander Melamed first became known as Soviet dissident artists. Just as American pop art commented on images from advertising and mass media, Komar and Melamed satirized Soviet poster art with its images of Lenin and Stalin, and commented on Soviet socialist realism. Komar and Melamed have collaborated on works of art since 1965. They left the Soviet Union in 1977 as Jewish emigres to Israel. A year later, they came to New York. In 1987, they became U.S. citizens. They currently have a major installation at the Brooklyn Museum. Komar and Melamed told me their membership in the Moscow Union of Artists was revoked in the mid-70s. I asked what the consequences were for an artist to be thrown out of the union.
In our times, it was not a big problem. We lost an access to art materials, art supplies, but we got this access through our friends. Hopefully, it happened in the 70s, which were quite good times by Russian standards, because if it would happen, if it happened 10 years before, we could be imprisoned or something terrible could happen with us. But in our case, it was nothing, you know, special happened to us as citizens or as an artist.
Now, since your work was satirical in content, do you think it was any more or less offensive to the authorities than, say, abstract art was?
At that time, it was more offensive, of course, because the authorities could feel the closeness to this art. They feel that they understand what is going on, but something wrong is going on. It was like a distorted mirror, you know, when you look in this art, they saw their faces, but not official faces, you know, like real faces or distorted faces. So they saw themselves differently from that art, and that what irritated them so much.
You both participated in an art show that was written about around the world. It was around, I think, 16 years ago. It was an outdoor show in a park that became known as the Bulldozer Show because the authorities came, busted up the show, and even tried to bulldoze over it. They said that they needed the park area to plant trees and that you had to evacuate so they could start planting. What are some of your most vivid memories of that day?
It was a very exciting day. You know, I think this the climax of our artistic life. We always were dreaming to repeat this day, you know, to make another day like that, because what could be more exciting than provoking a real anger and feeling from the viewer, for the artist. So, and this was a really great event, because we felt that our art is important for somebody, important to such a degree that the people trying to destroy it. And as I said, it was real. It was frightening, of course, terribly frightening, but it makes it more exciting.
I remember that how the one of the authorities took our painting from my hand. It was our double self-portrait, and broke it and threw it out to the mess. And I remember my thought. I thought, that's mean our art touch this person so deep that his reaction so, you know, active, so violent.
Would you describe that double portrait painting that was destroyed?
It was a two profile on the red background in style of official portraits of Lenin and Stalin.
But it was you both.
Yes, it was our profiles.
That's how our collaboration has worked, and that's why we started to work together as collaborators, because from our childhood we always have had an image of great guys working as collaborators. So Lenin and Stalin was, of course, the most important figures for us, and we were trying, till now maybe, we're trying to imitate these great guys.
Well, you live in one in New York, one in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the New York art scene, I think, just as in the Soviet Union you were exposed to the extremes of communism, I'd assume the New York art scene you're exposed to some of the extremes of capitalism, in the sense that for a lot of people in New York, art is commodity, investment, status symbol. I'm curious about your feelings about the New York art scene.
It's terrible. Devastating, yeah. Worse than the Russian system, maybe, because in Russia you can beat the system using the you can use the foreign cultures, you know, American culture, European culture, as an alternative to Russian culture. But in America, there is only American culture, of course, in art. So you don't have any alternative. Just you're stuck in this art scene and you forever.
You mean you can't dream of going to America where it's going to be better?
Yeah, that's it, yeah. There is no place. There is far west, you know. There is no way out. And that's a terrible feeling that you are confined and that's it. There is no freedom in this system. And there is no freedom of choice. And there is some choice, but it's a fictional choice. And not a real freedom, I mean.
I think the great period of American art, the greatest period, was a late 40s and early 50s, because America had the inferiority complex that America is provincial country, and it gave a lot of energy to the artist.
I think that generally speaking, the art which is produced now in the United States of America, I mean official art or recognized art, is the worst ever produced in the history of art.
What don't you like about it?
Just a general feeling. You know, there's some good artists, definitely, but I mean the whole establishment and the whole system of art is the worst ever.
You were talking about the lack of freedom in the New York art scene.
Yeah.
Well, what do you mean by that? I mean, you're free to create anything you want to.
Oh, no, it's not true, because, you know, you're manipulated by media, you know, not only the simple or, you know, layman manipulated by media, but of course, in artists themselves and everybody in this country. So you're manipulated, you know, you're forced in a very sophisticated way, not like a stupid Russian government which used bulldozers, which were not effective at all, but in a very sophisticated way we're manipulated by this system.
Do you think the art is trivial?
Yeah, the good example is Andy Warhol, which, and he is a ultimate hero of this system, you know, just to be part of the system, to make as much money as possible, to use media as a vehicle to be famous, and for 15, 20, a couple of hours, doesn't matter, because in this system, time doesn't exist.
I'm wondering if you also miss the extra power that art has when that art is forbidden.
It's not problem of power of art or not power. It's problem of expectation. The spectators in Russia really took artists as a political figure, also as a kind of prophet, as a kind of preach. And they really expect from the art to decision of religious problem of politics, also economical problem and philosophical problem, etc. And here sometimes we're really very sad to feel yourself as a part of hobby of rich people.
Oh, a rich people's hobby.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Rich people's hobby.
How much freedom do you think artists have now under Gorbachev? How do you think life has changed for artists in the Soviet Union?
Now they have freedom to leave country and to live abroad and to be part of American European art. That's the only freedom they got, and that's what they were fighting for.
But you think life would still be pretty unpleasant for a painter in the Soviet Union?
Oh, yeah, sure. What does, you know, most of the artists, you know, I spoke all around the world, they're dreaming about some huge places when they are, you know, when they were supposed to be the best, you know, concentration of the best artists. Like, you know, the people from, we were in Australia for a couple of months, and the people were speaking only about how to get to New York, you know, how to manage to live in New York. Same talk which we have in the Soviet Union now. So, but life for the artist, of course, is not very exciting in Russia. Life in Russia is not very exciting.
Are you going to go back there and visit?
Oh, we visited. Yeah, I was once, and Vitaly was two times in Russia.
When you go to the Soviet Union to visit and see artist friends there, do you tell them how cynical you've become about the New York art scene?
You know, when I came to the Soviet Union first, you know, trying to reach my artist friends, I discovered that most of them now live in the West most of the time.
Uh-huh.
And of course, relation of authorities to our art changed a lot. For example, they invite us to have an official show in Moscow at the end of next year.
Oh, are you surprised by that?
Oh, yes, it's a big way from the bulldozer show to the official show.
So now we're official Russian artists, the classics of Russian art.
So you'll be going over for that show?
You see? Yeah, I think so. I don't know. Yeah, sure. I don't know. No. We're very ambivalent, you know, very suspicious about everything which is coming out of Russia.
So you're even suspicious about becoming officially okay in the Soviet Union?
Absolutely. We spent so much time to fight, you know, against officialdom of Russia, and now we're accepted as official artists.
Maybe that they can accept us mean that our art change in bad side.
You mean you've gotten too tame?
Yes.
Okay, we'll see. The future will tell us what is going on in Russia, in our lives, and everywhere.
Well, thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Komar and Melamed's installation at the Brooklyn Museum will remain on exhibit through June 4th. Komar and Melamed are the subject of a new book by Carter Radcliffe, published by Abbeville Press. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. What is coming up, Noah?
Hi, Terry. NPR's John Madison reports from Namibia. On that country's new independence, Mike Schuster from Berlin, on the timetable for unification for the two Germanys. We'll have an update on the Greyhound strike from John Burnett in Texas, and the story of the ultimate cave exploration, hundreds of feet deep under Mexico. A new underwater breathing apparatus has been invented, enabling the divers to stay underwater for hours at a time. Also, the movie director Keenan Wayans tells us about the actor and comedian Robin Harris, who has died at age 36, and Bob Mondello reviews a new film in which Robin Harris plays a featured role. It's called House Party.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. David McClellan is a leading scholar of Karl Marx and Marxism. He's a professor of political theory at the University of Kent in England. In his new biography, Utopian Pessimist, McClellan explores the life and ideas of the eccentric French thinker Simone Weil. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
Simone Weil, the French philosopher and mystic, starved herself to death in wartime London in 1943. Ever since, her brilliant essays and her peculiar life have excited the morbid interest of everybody from Susan Sontag to Simone de Beauvoir to historians of religion and antiquity. I've read her myself as an extreme case, almost as if she were a character in a desperately serious modern novel. David McClellan's wonderful new biography changes my mind. She was trying to save my soul as well as her own. How difficult she must have been. Clumsy, homely, frail, repressed, an exasperation and a reproach. An unfriendly professor in the 1930s called her the Red Virgin. She'd allow no one, ever, to touch her. Farmers for whom she worked didn't want her around because she never washed her hands or changed her clothes, and was always talking about poverty, deportations, and the future martyrdom of the Jews. When offered a fine cream cheese, she refused it, saying that the little Indochinese were hungry. In the 34 years she took to starve herself to death, she went from a Jewishness she denied to a Christianity about which she was too scrupulous and tentative, from a politics that was a hodgepodge of Descartes and Marx to a theology that was a hodgepodge of Plato, Pythagoras, and the Gnostics, from a pacifism that would have given Hitler whatever he wanted to a guilt that sent her stumbling to the front in the Spanish Civil War to a patriotism that wanted to parachute itself into occupied France. A year before her death, she wrote, "Every time I think of the crucifixion of Christ, I commit the sin of envy." When she died, her long flirtation with the Catholic Church unconsummated, the coroner called it suicide. She had refused to eat enough to keep herself alive. A priest was supposed to attend her funeral, but missed his train. Ideas hit Weil like swords, and so did beauty. Leonardo, St. Francis of Assisi, Bach's Fourth Brandenburg Concerto. To read her is to wince, and oh my, could she write, like Stendhal. But McClellan, whose many books on Marx and Marxism are models of political theory made accessible to the non-specialist, is interested in her ideas, not her style. He calls her a French Kafka, a cross between Pascal and Orwell. She understood the evils of Stalinism as early as 1932, and the evils of colonialism decades before Malraux and Camus. She knew all about technological alienation from firsthand experience in the factories, while the rest of them were still blabbing about it in cafes. Her contemplation, McClellan says, was not a means of stopping a nauseating world and getting off, but of seeing the world in a different and truer perspective, and above all, of developing a sharp eye and ear for the traces of God in all human activity and experience. It was as if, because of her radical individualism, she saw through nationalism, trade unionism, the Hebrews, and the Romans. What she sought on the other side was lucidity, which she called God. Or to borrow her own image, Christ on the cross as a fulcrum, a point of rest between magnitudes, establishing balance and proportion. Leon Trotsky himself complained that Weil's mission was, quote, to defend her personality against society. McClellan has made me see that this ought to be the mission of all of us, or we will starve for meaning.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Utopian Pessimist, The Life and Thought of Simone Weil by David McClellan. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shurrock. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist T.J. English tells us about the rise and fall of the Westies, the Irish mob that operated in New York's Hell's Kitchen. They were often the Italian mafia's hired hitmen. Also, we meet exiled Cuban novelist and poet Herberto Padilla. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.